southern Iranian city of Bandar Abbas witnesses a ceremony welcoming the Navy's 86th flotilla back home after a mission around the world. Meantime, the Chief of the Staff of the Armed Forces tells Press TV that the flotilla accomplished its mission in defiance of U.S. threats and pressure. Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound once again amid heightened tensions in the occupied lands. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. An official ceremony has been held in the southern Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas to welcome a naval flotilla back home, and that after a successful journey around the world. It was attended by top military brass, including Chief of General Staff of the Armed Forces. Major General Mohammad Daghari said that the expedition marks the beginning of a new chapter in the development of Iran's naval power. The general added that the mission is a unique achievement for a navy subject to sanctions and other propaganda and pressure. The flotilla included domestically manufactured Dana destroyer and Macron forward base ship. They entered Iranian waters on May 17th. The flotilla completed a 63,000-kilometer journey around the Earth in 8 months. It marked the first time an Iranian naval group entered the Pacific. The vessel sailed to South America and visited South Africa before returning home. Earlier, we were joined by correspondent Kisumi Shahmedi, who has some details about the flotilla's unique voyage. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
I am at the port city of Bandar Abbas in the south of Iran. The 86th flotilla is back from its round-the-world trip, a very specific and special experience for the Iranian Navy. Let's mention that not all navies in the world have this type of experience, touring the entire world, traveling through all the major oceans, the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, some very dangerous maritime routes that they've passed. And, of course, this is all done because of the technical development of the Iranian Navy, the fact that it has acquired state-of-the-art know-how and technology in order to be able to carry out such an important and dangerous, in many cases, mission that not all navies, as I mentioned before, would be able to take on, traveling through all the important and major canals in the world. And, of course, let's also point out to the fact that this was done because of an atmospherology software that was developed by Iranian technicians. Now, to find out more about the technical aspects and the major developments in this field, I am joined by the technical commander of the Iranian Navy, who is joining me right now to tell us more about this.
The all-Iranian Dana destroyer and the Macron forward base ship are the result of round-the-clock efforts by technical experts at the Iranian Navy and the Defense Ministry, and they managed to pass through all this long route. It is almost 60,000 kilometers they sailed across that route, and that suggests the technical progress of our youth. With the help of this software, we were able to predict what would happen in the seas, and this was one of the secrets to our success, and we knew what we were supposed to do.
Our correspondent also asked the Chief of the Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Baghali, about the U.S. pressure campaign against the flotilla, and this is what he had to say.
Tell us about the U.S. The U.S. had threatened countries, had asked countries not to allow the Iranian flotilla, the Iranian warships, to dock in their countries. However, we saw that despite U.S. threats, countries like Brazil did not heed the U.S. threats, and also some sanctions had been imposed on this flotilla. The 8-month voyage by this flotilla around the world showed that we can, with reliance on our own capabilities, we can be present in any place in the world, in the oceans around the world, wherever the maritime law allows us to. So we docked at 5 ports during this voyage. The U.S. tried to threaten those countries and ask them not to allow the Iranian warships to dock there, but it didn't happen. And the U.S. should accept that the leverage that it shows, that it uses in the world, those levers are losing their power, are waning, and countries are trying to remain independent, and countries want to decide about their own future. You are seeing these developments in countries in the southern part of the Persian Gulf, and our flotilla, you saw that, docked in those countries. U.S. threats are, in fact, threadbare threats. They are saying that they have just kept themselves alive by making these threats. They want to create the impression that they are the masters of the world, and the U.S. wants just to create the impression that it remains a master and a world power.
The spokesman of the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Nasser Kanani, says that the mission of the Navy's 86th flotilla indicates the fact that U.S. sanctions against Iran can be broken.
Iran, during this major mission, showed that cruel sanctions by the U.S. Can be broken, and this mission rekindled hope in the hearts of independent nations around the world, and told countries which are going to wean themselves off the dependence of major powers that through national might they can actually break the obstacles of the world hegemony. This move by Iran rekindled hope in nations, in friendly nations and countries. Also, it increased Iran's national dignity, and we thank God Almighty for that. Our brave personnel, I mean naval personnel, we congratulate them all on this, and we are confident that this move will definitely tip the balance of international equations, including in international naval arena, in Iran's favor. And the enemies should take into consideration this fact.
Well, the commander of the Russian Navy says that only a powerful country is able to accomplish the mission of sailing around the world on Navy vessels.
All I can say is that only a superpower can send a flotilla on a voyage around the globe. I am very pleased to see Iran has such a naval fleet. The fact that this flotilla has circumnavigated the world indicates that these vessels were technically prepared and that its crew were well trained and experienced.
Also, author and commentator John Stepling argues the Iranian flotilla's journey around the world indicates the U.S.'s declining power.
I think the story of the flotilla is really the decline of American power, the decline of American influence. It's just another, you know, perhaps symbolic, but also perhaps a bit more than that. Of the lack of U.S. control of not just the narrative, but look, they docked in Brazil. Brazil is a significant country. It's a BRICS country, number one, and it is a trade partner with the U.S. The U.S. has close relations with Brazil, and yet, Brazil ignored the U.S. pressure and allowed the Iranian ships to dock. What we're seeing globally right now, over the last, say, 5 years, has been this gradual but inexorable decline of influence in the U.S. And all the countries, which are several dozen countries that the U.S. sanctions, but primarily the big ones being Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, Syria, And now Russia, of course, these countries are doing fine. They're doing fine.
In other news, at least six Iranian border guards have been killed in a terrorist attack southeast of the country. It took place in the Saravan region in Sistan and Balochistan province. Border guards engaged in armed clashes with terrorists trying to cross into Iran. The terrorists were pushed back across the border after suffering deadly losses. Sistan and Balochistan province shares a long border with Pakistan and has seen several terrorist attacks targeting both civilians and security forces. Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound again, further fueling anti-Israeli sentiments. The controversial move came 3 days after the politician, along with tens of thousands of Israeli extremists, marched through the occupied Old City of Al-Quds and just over a week into a fragile Gaza ceasefire. With tensions flaring up in the occupied Palestinian lands, he said that Israel is in charge of Al-Quds. Meanwhile, Hamas has announced that the Israeli regime will be responsible for the consequences of the presence of Ben-Gvir and settlers in the mosque. Our correspondent, Ramallah Monacandil, was earlier with us with the reactions to the controversial visit by the far-right Israeli minister to Al-Aqsa Mosque.
This morning, Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, claiming that the Israeli authorities and the Israeli occupation will always be the masters of Al-Quds and the entire land of Israel, and that the complex there is owned by the Israelis. Immediately, a statement issued by the spokesman of the Palestinian Authority, Nabil Abu Rdena, calling on the raid by Ben-Gvir as a flagrant attack on Al-Aqsa, and he also warned that it would have serious repercussions. He said that the raid of Ben-Gvir, describing him as an extremist minister at the early hour like thieves into the Al-Aqsa Mosque Square, will impose, will not change reality and will not impose Israeli sovereignty. The Foreign Ministry of Jordan also issued a statement condemning the raid of Ben-Gvir in the strongest terms, calling it a dangerous and unacceptable escalation. Hamas movement also issued a statement saying the Hamas movement will not leave Al-Aqsa alone and warned that Israel will bear responsibility for the barbaric incursions of its ministers and herds of settlers.
Palestinians have gathered in the besieged Gaza Strip to commemorate those who lost their lives during the recent Israeli aggression. Demonstrators vowed to continue their resistance until the full liberation of their land. They also pledged to give Israel a crushing response in case of any future attack.
Thousands have rallied in the besieged Gaza Strip to commemorate the martyrdom of several commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement during the recent Israeli aggression on the coastal territory. The rally also honored those civilians who fell victim to the regime's onslaught earlier this month. The demonstrators vowed to maintain their resistance in the face of the regime's atrocities against Palestinians. In an address to the ralliers, one of the leaders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, Khalid al-Bach, remembered the group's commanders who were assassinated during the five-day Israeli onslaught. Bach said, "We want to tell the whole world that though the F-16 airstrikes and the American 139 rockets were fired toward us, this nation is still alive and will continue the resistance." He said, "We attest our right to freedom. From their blood, we'll continue the resistance. From their death, we received the power to face the Zionists. We will continue." Meanwhile, a similar event was held in the Syrian capital Damascus, where Islamic Jihad Secretary General addressed ralliers. Ziad al-Nakhala hailed the Palestinians' victory against Israel during the regime's recent aggression against Gaza. He said the regime was forced to accept Palestinians' terms for a ceasefire in the face of hundreds of rockets fired into the occupied territories. Nakhala added that Palestinians dealt another hefty blow to Israel's already tarnished image. The official attributed the Palestinian victory to their unity and sacrifices. Nakhala vowed a strong and painful response to any future Israeli assassination of the group's commanders.
Well, that report brings to the end of this newscast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The Republican Party has lost contact with nearly all of the whistleblowers in their ongoing investigation into President Joe Biden. Marjorie Taylor Greene confirmed on Monday, 15th of May. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has covered this story and tells us more. The Republican Party has lost contact with nearly all of the whistleblowers in their ongoing investigation into President Joe Biden, Marjorie Taylor Greene confirmed on Monday, 15th of May. According to the Georgia Republican, most of the informants are missing in action, except for one. That whistleblower is very safe, Marjorie Taylor Greene told Steve Bannon on his War Room podcast. But he does fear for his life, and rightfully so. While Greene claims to be in touch with that one witness, the same can't be said for up to nine others. That whistleblower came through for us, thankfully, through the help of Senator Grassley, she said. But other whistleblowers, yes, they are missing, either in jail or we cannot talk to them at this time because they cannot be found. And our investigation is so important, Steve, that this will bring down the President of the United States, Marjorie Taylor Greene added. Taylor Greene's explanation comes after Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, told Fox News Channel on Sunday that they'd lost contact with at least one key informant. The national broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story. An IRS whistleblower who claims to have information about alleged mishandling and political interference in the ongoing criminal probe into Hunter Biden has been removed from the investigation into the president's son. Attorneys for the whistleblower have told key congressional lawmakers. Attorneys for the whistleblower sent a letter on Monday, 15th of May, to a series of House and Senate committee chairmen informing them of the change, adding that the whistleblower's investigative team has also been taken off the case, according to a copy of the letter obtained by CNN. The attorneys, including Tristan Leavitt, president of Empower Oversight, and Mark Little, added that the whistleblower was informed the change was at the request of the Department of Justice. The letter states that it is an investigation of a high-profile controversial subject, which sources familiar with the matter have previously confirmed to CNN was President's son, Hunter Biden. Federal prosecutors have spent years spanning three attorney general investigating Hunter Biden and have weighed bringing charges against him for alleged tax crimes and a false statement. So far, no charges have been filed. Hunter Biden has denied any wrongdoing. In a statement on Tuesday, 16th of May, the IRS declined to comment on a specific taxpayer matter. In general, the IRS, the Inland Revenue Service, is deeply committed to protecting the role of whistleblowers, and there are robust processes and procedures in place to protect whistleblowers. An IRS commissioner, Danny Werfel, has stated, "We will not tolerate retaliation against any IRS employee making a whistleblower allegation. When suggestions of wrongdoing are raised, we work with all appropriate parties, including the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, to ensure the integrity of the whistleblower process is safeguarded," according to the IRS statement. The department cannot comment on the matter, a Justice Department spokesperson said, as to any investigation of Hunter Biden. As the Attorney General has said, that investigation is being handled by U.S. Attorney David Weiss, who has full authority to make investigative decisions and to bring charges in any jurisdiction as he deems appropriate. An attorney for the IRS whistleblower didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Delaware, the office conducting the Hunter Biden criminal probe, declined to comment. White House spokesman Ian Sams previously said that President Biden has made clear that this matter would be handled independently by the Justice Department under the leadership of a U.S. attorney appointed by former President Trump, free from any political interference by the White House. He has upheld that commitment. Representative Richard Neal, the top Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee, said in a statement, "Ways and Means Democrats take whistleblowers and their protection seriously. More detail is needed here, and we call on Commissioner Werfel to provide the necessary context before making any further judgment," the statement said. The attorneys, Tristan Leavitt and Mark Little, claim in their letter that the move is clearly retaliatory and may also constitute obstruction of a congressional inquiry, a claim that stands in contrast to testimony made by IRS Commissioner Daniel Werfel in April, when he told the House Ways and Means Committee that, "I can say without any hesitation, there will be no retaliation for anyone making an allegation or a call to a whistleblower hotline." The attorney is right that given the agent has successfully sought whistleblower protection, he's protected from retaliatory personnel actions, and that any attempt by any government official to prevent a federal employee from furnishing information to Congress is also a direct violation of longstanding appropriations restriction, and that it is a crime to obstruct an investigation of Congress. The move to sideline the whistleblower and his investigative team comes months after some agents complained that they were no longer being included in some discussions about the case, in part because of alleged leaks, people familiar with the matter told CNN. The investigative work on the case is largely over, and the case awaits charging decision by U.S. Attorney David Weiss, a Donald Trump appointee who is overseeing the probe. The dispute is also not common in fights between Congress and the executive branch of the government over whistleblower complaints. There is no indication the agent in question has lost their job at the IRS. The letter was sent to Democratic and Republican chairmen, as well as the ranking members of the Senate Finance and Judiciary Committees and the House Ways and Means and Judiciary Committees. Attorneys Leavitt and Little asked the committee leaders to give the matter their prompt attention. Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee confirmed receipt of the letter to CNN, adding in a statement that the most recent communication concerning allegations of retaliatory actions against the whistleblower appears to contradict the sworn testimony by Commissioner Werfel, who pledged that whistleblower protections would be upheld. Congress's duty to hold government agencies accountable relies on the availability and willingness of individuals to speak out about wrongdoing. Not only does retaliation like this discourage whistleblowers, it can also rise to the level of an illegal violation of statutory protections for whistleblowers, the statement continued. CNN has previously reported that the IRS whistleblower alleges that Weiss' ability to bring charges in the case involving Hunter Biden is being thwarted by political appointees. That would contradict promises by Attorney General Merrick Garland in congressional testimony that Attorney Weiss, a Donald Trump appointee, has full authority to make final decisions on whether to prosecute the president's son, Hunter Biden. The IRS whistleblower also claimed to have information that contradicts sworn testimony to Congress by a senior political appointee, according to a previous letter from his attorney. That senior political appointee was Attorney General Merrick Garland. People familiar with the matter have confirmed to CNN. Time magazine has also covered this story and tells us more. The top Republican on the House Oversight Committee clarified on Monday that an informant the committee has lost touch with isn't related to the committee's demand that the FBI hand over internal investigative notes about President Joe Biden. House Oversight Chair James Comer is leading an investigation of overseas business transactions by companies he alleges benefited Biden's relatives during and shortly after the years that Biden was vice president. James Comer has so far failed to show how Biden may have benefited from the payments or how any alleged business dealings by relatives may have impacted Biden's policy decisions. He has repeatedly blamed stonewalling by the Biden administration for why his investigation hasn't gotten more traction. Then on Sunday, James Comer made the unusual disclosure to Fox News Channel that his office has lost touch with an informant in the investigation. "Well, unfortunately, we can't track down the informant. We're hopeful the informant is still there," Comer said. The remark led to widespread speculation that the missing informant was related to the Oversee Committee's fight with the FBI over handling over internal investigation notes and demands to know what actions, if any, the FBI took to investigate Joe Biden. It also sparked unfounded conspiracy theories online that Biden's allies have intervened to silence the informant. James Comer's office clarified on Monday that the informant he lost touch with is unrelated to the FBI records the committee is requesting. Jessica Collins, communications director for the House Oversight Committee, told Time magazine in an email that the whistleblower, who has come forward about the FBI record, alleged that then-Vice President Joe Biden engaged in a bribery scheme with a foreign national, isn't missing. James Comer was referring to another whistleblower regarding the Biden family's influence peddling schemes, Collins wrote.
ocean of dua.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. We will have a look at the general frame of supplication of Kumail. Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were trying to have a look at the different means of recourse in the supplication of Kumail applied by Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful. As we said, the first means was Allah's previous goodness and kindness. The second means is our love for him. This is the difference between the first and second means. In the first means Imam Ali alayhi salam uses the different forms of supplication, seeking recourse to Allah with his love for us, the love of the Almighty Allah for us. But in this stage, Imam Ali alayhi salam seeks recourse to him with our love for him. And the third means is our weakness to bear the torment, where Imam Ali alayhi salam discusses the delicacy of our skins, the frailty of our bones, and the fact that this the life of this world has little endurance and patience, because our weakness is an effective means to seek recourse with it to the strong and the strength of the Almighty Allah. Now, the fourth means with which Imam Ali alayhi salam seeks recourse to Allah in this supplication is the desperate need of the servant to Allah. This is what in better terms is called iltirar to the Almighty Allah. This is an effective means to someone before whom one presents his neediness and does not find any other person to fulfill his wish without him. He knows and he presents, confesses to the fact that, oh my Lord, I have no one else to confess to. I have no one else to turn to because you are my creator. You are my God and my absolute cause. And the point is, dear listeners, by desperate need, we mean a kind of state in which a servant does not find anyone else to fulfill his need apart from the Almighty Allah, the Exalted. That kind of feeling, that kind of situation, where the one does not have any place of refuge except with the Almighty Allah. The kind of situation in which one seeks shelter and protection with no one but the Almighty Allah. The kind of situation in which one takes flight from Allah, but does not find any shelter to seek protection with except Him, the Exalted. Such a scene is among the most effective in attracting Allah's mercy and clemency.
التي وسعت كل شيء. وبجبروتك التي خلقت بها كل شيء
وبجبروتك التي خلقت بها كل شيء
يا نور يا قدوس يا نور يا قدوس يا نور يا قدوس يا نور يا قدوس
يا أول الأولين يا آخر
So, brothers and sisters, the fourth means of recourse in the supplication of Kumail that Imam Ali alayhi salam uses is that state of iltirar, is that state of being in desperate need. A baby with her little world does not see any protector, any supporter, or the one who can fulfill her needs other than her father, her mother. So, she develops intimacy with them. She finds with them, within her little horizon, all her wishes. She knows that she has got no one else to turn to. She has got no one to seek refuge with. And what she needs of mercy, benevolence, and sympathy, she knows that only her parents can provide. Subsequently, whenever something befalls her, or she becomes afflicted by a calamity, or she becomes afraid of something, she immediately takes refuge with her parents. She finds security. She finds mercy with them and with no one else. This is the very first place she turns to in the time of afflictions. Moreover, if she has done something because of which she deserves to be punished by her parents, and she fears them for herself, then she would turn to her right and left looking for refuge. But when she finds, she realizes she has no one to give her protection, then she turns to her parents again, throwing herself into her arms, although she was fleeing from them. But now she's asking for their help. At the time when they are intending to punish her, even at that time, she turns to them. This is that state of being in desperate needs that Imam Ali alayhi salam uses. This fourth means with which Imam alayhi salam seeks recourse to Allah is iltirar. This is the state of being in desperate need. And this scene of the baby in which she does not have anyone to turn to except her parents, is among those which, most of the time, bring about the sympathy of her parents and earns their love and their affection. And now, in this prayer, Imam Ali alayhi salam is pointing to such a concept. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, addressing a group of citizens from the holy city of Qom. In part of his speech, delivered on the anniversary of the 1978 uprising in Qom against the then U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime, Ayatollah Khamenei touched on Washington's enmity towards Tehran since the early days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The leader of the Islamic Revolution then referred to a recent document published in the United States, which showed the Americans were after the fall of the Islamic regime through systematic subversive activities. But what was the document exactly, and how did the Americans intend to topple the fledgling republic? The document the Iranian leader referred to is related to a series of 359 documents dating back to the years between 1979 and 1980. Published by the Office of the Historian and Office of the United States Department of State.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly
swear. In one of these documents, then U.S. President Jimmy Carter considered operation against a foreign country important for American national security. Carter ordered propagandistic political and economic operations against the Islamic Republic in order to establish what he called a democratic and responsible regime in Iran. It was based on this order that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was provoked to launch an attack on Iran on September 22, 1980. Carter's order contained contacts with Iranian opposition leaders and concerned influential governments to form a Western-affiliated bloc that would be able to replace the Islamic Republic. The significance of the recently released document is that even Jimmy Carter, who is blamed at home for not being strict enough with Iran, was hell-bent on overthrowing the Islamic Republic. In November 1979, through Executive Order 12170, Carter froze about $8.1 billion U.S. dollars in Iranian assets, including bank deposits, gold, and other properties. It also imposed a trade embargo. At the same time, the Americans persuaded ambitious Saddam Hussein to invade Iran, dragging the country into an unwanted, unprovoked war. They imposed an arms embargo on Iran. The fact is, over the past four decades, the U.S. has spared no effort to undermine and, if possible, to topple the Islamic Republic of Iran. As an impeccable foe of the Islamic Revolution, Washington has applied various economic, trade, scientific, and military sanctions against Iran since 1979, while the antagonism towards Tehran has transferred from one administration to the next unrelentingly.
Well, we want to know all the facts. Acting Director McLaughlin said there was no direct connection between Iran and the attacks of September the 11th. We will continue to look and see if the Iranians were involved. I have long expressed my concerns about Iran. After all, it's a totalitarian society.
The second thing that we're going to continue to do is to apply the toughest sanctions and continue to mobilize the international community to make sure that Iran is further and further isolated.
In 2018, then U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA, imposing sanctions on Iran. Influenced by his national security advisor John Bolton and Benjamin Netanyahu, two notorious Iran hawks, Trump applied maximum pressure on the Iranian nation with the aim of the so-called regime change. In the heat of the tension between Washington and Tehran, after the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian hero in the fight against terrorism, Trump threatened to strike 52 Iranian cultural sites. In his presidential campaign in 2020, Biden left little doubt concerning the revival of the deal. But in practice, he was no different from his predecessor. His administration first began an after-you game with Iran, laying out a set of unrealistic conditions which Tehran naturally rejected. The aim was to blame Iran, though wrongfully, for not being cooperative, an anti-Iran propaganda.
I have to tell you, recent moves, recent rhetoric, don't give us a lot of cause for optimism. Even though the hour is getting very late, it is not too late for Iran to reverse course and engage meaningfully in an effort to return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA.
Last but not least, the enmity toward Iran is partly due to pressure from powerful interest groups, including the pro-Israel lobby. As Bill Clinton's Middle East envoy, Kenneth Pollack, once said, from a political standpoint, nobody pays a price to be tough on Iran. Whereas Israel is not a party to the NPT or the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, and at the same time the regime is estimated to have up to 400 nuclear warheads, it is Iran and not Israel which is being blamed for threatening the security of the region. In November 2020, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was regarded as the chief of Iran's nuclear program, was assassinated by Israel. The regime has already assassinated a number of Iranian scientists involved in the country's peaceful nuclear program. All in all, the Americans and their partners have never missed a chance to demonize Iran with the ultimate aim of bringing the nation to its knees, but all to no avail.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting question. A lot of people ask this question, you know, from religious scholars, because to be honest, there's no answer to this in science, modern science, you know. And that question is, why exactly do we sleep, and what happens when we sleep? This is not something that, you know, anybody can actually adequately answer without the help of revelation. And because of this, in order to answer this question, we will look at a very beautiful and noble hadith in which Imam Ali alayhi salam has kind of alluded to this topic and answered it. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, a Muslim will not sleep while in a state of ritual impurity, janabat. And he should not sleep without being in a state of purity. Why? Why is this? Imam answers, he says, if he does not, in continuation, the Imam says, if he does not find water, then he should perform dry ablution, tayammum. Tayammum is reference to when you don't have water, you strike your hands on the ground or the earth, and you perform a kind of ablution, which is to take place of the ablution with water. Then he should perform dry ablution with soil. Why? For the spirit of a believer, the Imam says, ascends to Allah Almighty, and he meets it and blesses it. Meaning, at the time of sleep, the spirit of the believer, it kind of partially separates from the body and ascends to find Allah and to meet Allah. If his time of death was to have come when in a state of purity, he places his spirit within the folds of his mercy. And if the person slept in a state of purity, right, Allah showers him with his mercy. And if his end has not come, meaning his time of death has not come, he sends it back, his spirit, with his guardian angels, and they return it to his body. It's probably because of this that, you know, in some hadiths, it's been narrated that sleep is the brother of death. An-nawmu akhul maut. It's a type of death, but it's not permanent, right? Meaning, unless the time of the person has come. Of course, sleeping, you know, it has its own etiquettes. If we follow these etiquettes, then, you know, obviously that meeting with Allah that occurs in this time, in this state, it will be more meaningful and more conscious even. For example, reciting the Quran and supplicating at bedtime, sleeping on one's a specific side, and before going to sleep, taking account of oneself, sleeping in a state of ritual purity and being clean, supplicating when one wakes up. These are all some of the etiquettes of in Islam, of sleeping. It's also interesting to note that in some hadiths, you know, these dreams that we see when we sleep, it's been narrated that God Almighty, He created these, right, so people could have an understanding of the nature of the hereafter and kind of comprehend how it will be. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what occurs during sleep according to religion. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.